living again and then 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 and then.
Hello there, welcome once more to G Race. Winnie, do you have any idea how we say this thing?
I don't think I speak your language, Ezra.
Hey, it's good to be back. How's it going?
It's a pretty nutty time in our country, but lots of prayers for safety and stability and for the inbreaking of God's kingdom. Boy, do we need it. Ezra, I'm so looking forward to today. I get to meet a friend of yours who I really admire.
Yes, so today we're going to be meeting David Nita. David is someone who I met many years ago. I went to this gathering of black and brown clergy, and he was one of the guest speakers. And he came in and just blew us all away with storytelling, sharing of movements he'd been involved in, and it really inspired us. And he said before he left, if any of you ever want to get in touch, all you need to do is ask. So I did. The church I was at, we had one of the things that David does is poetry. And we had an open mic night, so I invited him to come along and do some poetry. Not only did he come and do poetry, but he started mentoring people and supporting people. And I was just so delighted that he was so committed to seeing people flourish and thrive that he was there for us. And so it gives me great pleasure to have him along today. So shall we bring him in?
Yeah, right on.
Hello there, David.
Yes. Hello, my brother Azariah. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm really good. David, I'm so excited that I can be in a conversation with you and introduce you to Winnie. This is just going to be a real blast.
Okay. I believe that, my brother.
Hi, David.
Hi, Winnie. How are you?
Great. Great to meet you here. I so admired your contribution to Azariah's book release. It was just fantastic.
As did I admire your interview with Azariah. That really inspired me, you know. So great to meet you. Cyber technology.
Yeah, whatever this is. Really looking forward to the conversation.
So, David, I remember when I met you, one of the things that you shared with us was before moving to the UK, that you'd written a letter to one of our senior figures in the country. And I wonder, David, would you tell us about that? And maybe even would love to hear that special letter.
Right. So, thanks for that reminder, Azariah. I'll share the poem. The poem is called Letter to My Queen. And it's subtitled A Cat May Look at a King, which is an English proverb, which is about equality. And I wrote the poem in Patois. So letter to my queen. My dear Queen Elizabeth from London, England. My name is Dave, and I'm a raw born Jamaican. May I come to England for the very first time, and I'm so excited, but I jump and whine. My passport don't look out, and my ticket don't book. Me can't wait for reach a London for walk up and down and look. Me say England cool and rain always a fall. So me go wear me galoshes, me straw hat and me overall. Me say English people walk fast like them really stark mad. Me no care about that as long as them no bad. The ambassador where you send out ice kinda freeze up him brain. But the hot Jamaican sun tight out and now him quite sane. When few people come down to Jamaica, we treat them like royalty. So when me come up to England, me expect the same hospitality. Me now know if I stay, through me a compound short notice. So please me ask you if I fix me up a room in a Buckingham Palace. Me no like England food, so no better give me no shepherd's pie. Strictly banana porridge and ital food for I and I. Me so excited about seeing you, me know say like thief me and you going to be thick. Make sure you send Prince Philip to come pick me up, me land at the airport then call Gatwick. Me and you will drink some tea when me come and reason together when me come. So write and tell me if you need anything. And by the way, may I bring my puss? She said she want to come look upon the king. So that was letter to the queen. Now by then, Azariah, when I wrote that poem in the 90s, mid-90s, I had already known that that was a naive perspective. I mean, even from Jamaica, you know, I knew that this is kind of like a romanticized sense of monarchy.
Well, and maybe, and David, the larger question I have for you is, having made this move, which is both kind of a spiritual, personal shift, as you're saying, as a Jamaican coming to the mother country, right? And speaking to the mother in so many ways, right? Which is different than as an American, Caribbean folks that come to New York, come with a slightly different take on where they're coming and what they're for. So I find this fascinating. So I'd love to know how you think about home and what that transition has been, if that shifted, or what that's like for you where you are now.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I do recognize the difference, because there are two main thinking about home and motherland in what you'd call the African diaspora. One is a thinking that home is Africa. Home is the motherland, where we are from, where we're originally from, and so on. And you might find that people above a certain age think of the motherland as England. So that therein you find an issue. Whereas in America, I suppose England would be, you know, you're broken off from there and you're a republic. So I can see the difference between an American coming here and somebody from the Caribbean, let's say, coming here. And so home for me is London, England. But more than that, home for me is where I am. Home for me is Kingston, Jamaica. When I'm in Kingston, Jamaica, equally it's home for me when I'm in London, England. That's an interesting view, because most people, wherever they are in the world, a lot of people who are living in places where they didn't originally come from, they think of home as a place where they originated from. Not me. Because I see this thing as the earth is the Lord's. The whole earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And that I belong to the Lord, and so therefore this is my space, this is my, and I feel at home here in London.
And David, so following on from that, I wonder if you could tell us, give us an example of how you make home for others. You know, what you can do to help people, maybe those who are on the margins or society, or they're fractured and bruised. What do you do to help make home for them?
That's a good question, Azariah, and I'm going to lead into that question with, I mean, I'd mentioned a poem that I wrote, and it really segues into that line of question in terms of making home for others. I wanted to have a foil to the poem, The Letter to the Queen, to give a more of a realism to what London is like. So I wrote Lone Dun in London, which is, you know, breaking up London to form Lone Dun. And it just says, some time ago I lived in a land where it was commonplace to lend a hand. As a community worker, I was considered a don. But foreign attracted me. I wanted freedom. No, my life is different. I find myself lonely. My closest friend is my mate, melancholy. I'm cold and destitute. People call me a vagabond. I'm living in the West, in the city of London.
So, David, I know you as an artist. That's how I've experienced you from here. It's what I can find online. And you're talking about a therapeutic use of your art, if I'm understanding correctly, and how you are helping people that are struggling to find home, even within their own bodies and minds, in the work that you do. Can you say more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So as it turns out, I started to use my poetry to work along the therapeutic lines within mental health settings. And at this stage, I'm already in London training and being called to the bar of England and Wales. And I'm a barrister and basically have access to Lincoln's Inn. And every barrister have to be a member of this inn, this old British tradition. And as much as I might critique the nation, it's still home for me. And I want to change home to be a better home. Part of my privilege is to be able to dine at Lincoln's Inn. I'm working in mental health wards, and I decide I want to invite the patients of the wards and the people working in the wards into my home, which is part of it is Lincoln's Inn, because I make London my whole home. I invite them into the home, and it causes a kerfuffle, because we sit at the table, we're dining, and everything is running smoothly. They're enjoying the meal, they're having a fantastic time, but in the rule book, I'm only allowed 3 guests at a time. So I become known as the person who bring lots of people into Lincoln's Inn, and I've done that with students, with mental health patients, with people from the church, anybody I'm connected to, I want to bring them into spaces that they wouldn't normally come into, because I believe we should all make this great city our home. And it's home for me, and I want to make it home for others.
That's brilliant. And David, you know, that sense of bringing people into spaces, you also have that sense of going into other spaces as well. And as when you were saying, you know, about your artistry, you've shared some stories about things that you've done which demonstrates you're happy and willing to cross thresholds in order to appreciate art. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in terms of crossing these thresholds, London is perhaps the richest city when it comes to art and culture. You know, much of it is stolen from the rest of the world. When you consider the British Museum, for example, as one senior senior executive within the British Museum told some of my students, this should be called anything but the British Museum. This was a white man, by the way, senior executive, said this should be called anything but the British Museum because nothing here is British. It's all from other places. Okay, so that being said, there's lots of contemporary art in London too. I don't think per square mile there's any other places with more art galleries. It's common to see parties going on as you're walking through London. I notice coming home after work, you see these parties going on. I walk into these spaces, into these parties, because there's art on the wall and there's champagne being used to toast. And I walk into these spaces and grab a glass and start conversations. And it's mostly all right. But I'm challenged sometimes and say, were you invited? And I say, hold on a second. I look around. How do you come to me alone? Is it because I'm the only black man here? I'm the high degree of visibility around here, right? You should be glad that I'm in here, because otherwise it looks like London, you're turning London into an apartheid state. And so I say, you better put me on the mailing list. And then when I'm on the mailing list, I bring other people from communities like mine. So I started a campaign to get these art galleries to invite people from all over the place. And I, you know, lead the charge.
And so, you know, in that spirit, a few years ago when I was, when I knew that I had the opportunity to write my book, I saw that the presiding bishop, Michael B. Curry, was going to be coming to Southwark Cathedral. And I was really excited. And so I was going to buy a book, have him sign it, and then I was going to ask him if he might endorse my book when it came out. But then I got there late. I was right at the very back of the cathedral, and I could just see him in the distance. And then the presenter got up and said, because of time, Bishop Curry isn't able to do any signings or anything like that. So let's just give him a round of applause. So everyone stood to give him a standing ovation. In that moment, it was like I had this split second decision to make. And I walked from the back of the cathedral to the front of the cathedral, found a little space, and then saw, as he was being taken off with a little cohort of people into the cathedral vestry, there was someone on security on the door. They looked away for a second, and I joined the back of the group and walked into the vestry. And Bishop Michael Curry saw me, walked towards me, took me by the hand and said, "Hello there, Father." And we had this conversation, and I took a selfie with him. That sense of boundary crossing. I wonder, Winnie, have you got some thoughts or examples of when you've had to, you know, take an opportunity that you weren't presented with?
Well, you know, part of what I'm thinking about, what this is causing me to think about, is how immigrants, my parents are immigrants, and I'm a little bit, right, that come to the U.S., come to the U.K. and encounter racism for the first time, right? And in this place where we are, absolutely, my parents would say, more free to make a life with a stability they could not make in India, right? But it did mean that they walked into places that were for white people, and they didn't know. They had no clue that that was a reality, and they were also appalled by it, and regularly stood up for me and my brother in racist incidents in school that it was just shocking to them. They had no idea that's what they were supposed to expect and accept. And so they had no way to train us to accept it, and so they defied it. But what I'm struck by is, in the Episcopal Church as well, what you find is that immigrants come to our church because they expect there to be room for them in an Anglican church, that it's for them, it's their church. And often people that are second, third, or have been in this country for many years know that that is not their space. and wouldn't bother, right, can find another space that is more protective of them and their identity, and have made separate spaces for themselves. And often it is immigrant people that defy those boundaries because it's just not part of what we were raised up with. We haven't been put in our place properly. So I'm curious about this as we go into the next space about how we then think about church to open that up, to really make that a place of home and of fostering real change around ideas like that.
I'm curious, David, of your thoughts of, if you were to walk into the church that I am looking after and have leadership responsibility with, or if you were to go to where Winnie is in New York, what would you be looking to? What would you be hoping to encounter to help you to feel that you were at home in that space?
Well, you know, Azaria, it was exposed very early on to a man by the name of Tom Skinner, who was, you know, had a massive impact on my life. And he spoke, he was a gangster in New York who became a Christian. And he articulated the gospel in a way that I so really valued. He talked about the kingdom of God being a place where that's the sphere where God is in control. And therefore the church, when we're taught to pray, "Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven," that the church is supposed to represent the kingdom of heaven. So therefore, when you walk into a church, it ought to look like what heaven looked like. And yet, when we do that, Azariah, we don't find that in the church. When West Indians came up into England, for example, that's just one example, we're often told there's another church down the road, or your offering is not welcome here, you're not welcome here. We're made to feel unwelcome. Many people who I'm working with and trying to help now within the Church of England have told horror stories of the Church of England and what they've experienced, including what I've read in your book, which has been very useful in terms of my ministry outside the church. So the expectations are not high, but what we ought to have in those, in our sanctuaries, are spaces where people can say, this is what the kingdom of God should look like, where there's peace, harmony, love, welcome, where there's diversity and appreciation, participation, involvement in on every level. We don't find that, sadly.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in immigrant church, so part of the experience I don't have is going into white churches hoping for space or any culture that was not ours. So, but that happened because our parents were not welcomed into other spaces, and so they created their own, which is a very immigrant story. It's not part of my experience that the church is not for me. You know, my experience is you build the church together wherever, and you need to build the church, as Dave is saying, because if we want the inbreaking of the kingdom, we're told this is actually one of the ways that we focus that energy. We create that model and we create power for it. And so as an adult in the institutional church, I have to say I came in extremely naive, and I was moved through a process of ordination from very diverse congregations. I went to Union Seminary, a very diverse and liberationist focused seminary. So I walked into the Episcopal Church a little bit surprised. I had never thought about what percentage of it was white, what its history. I didn't care, frankly. I saw it as local and expressing something in a local context. But I think that the truth of that church, if we want to express the inbreaking, right, if we want to be prepared for it, is that power has to shift all the time. When I was in seminary, I remember standing in our church in Harlem one day as a big white guy in charge who had been doing this work in black communities forever. And he looked at me one day when he went out with a gospel book, which only the ordained can read in our tradition, and he handed it to me as a student. And I talked to him about it later, and he said, "Just occurred to me as I was standing up there, why am I up here speaking and all of you listening to me in a room full of people of color?" It's like, exactly, sir, exactly. He just, literally just passed his power over. And I think that symbolizes what we in the church have to do if we want to become who we say we want to be, what we're called to be.
It makes me think a bit about how people can have access to other spheres of life. You know, we talked about the earth is the Lord's. And so how do we continue to have the courage to cross those thresholds? And in the conversation we've had before, David, you know, just thinking about there are so many things which are on offer for us as black and brown people, but there's so many other things which are hidden away from us and that we don't know about. And actually, we don't have the desire, or we find it hard to imagine other realities because we don't even know that those rooms exist, you know, let alone where we find the keys. I'm just curious as to what some of your thoughts are in terms of creating access and pathways for people to encounter that they didn't even know was there.
So I would describe these places where they are locking people out and denying they're denying the rich sort of mix of different cultures. They're really sores. They're pustules of infestation, right? And what they need to do is lance that, allow in the other agents, the oxygen, the sunlight, and all these other elements in to heal that wound. That's how I see it. It's what you did when you got to the back of that line, when you wanted to see Bishop Curry. Because, you know, there's a certain, even within communities, we can have these walls being built. It's what your parents did, Winnie, when they decided that, you know, all of it is for us. And it's what the Black Church, as you described, Winnie, and as you know, when they said, okay, well, if we're not welcome here, we'll set up places of welcome. I know that I am ignorant of so many halls and avenues and of opportunity right now. But the moment I discover it, I go into it and I try to share that with other people. And so we are the people who, we don't know our places, which is, thank God we don't know. We're naive. We're ignorant. So we don't know what is what. All we know is a sense of justice. And if something doesn't appear to be that way, we challenge it. And then we find ourselves on the inside. And then when we're on the inside, we use our foot and catch the door, you know, or pull up a window. We do as many things as we can to let others in, to share in that privilege that we have as well.
David, I know that you've spoken about, you know, being a barrister, being a lawyer. Also, we've spoken about your poetry. I'm just wondering, how do you put those two worlds together? Do you? Or is it, you know, different things to you?
They come together as a package, can't really do one without the other. There is a creative side to law, and if you miss the creative side to law, then I feel like you miss the whole point of law. So there is justice, but there's also mercy. There's also grace. So in looking at the law, for example, the way I work with my clients is that often my clients don't have the money to pay. Often, I'm getting payments for representing a case by somebody saying, have some dinner with me then, right? And I accept that because access to justice is not easy. And when only the rich can afford access to justice, then justice is not justice, but it's a brand of legalism that excludes the poor, and it creates a bias towards those who are powerful in society. And then the gap between those two worlds become greater and greater. So I look at my profession, my legal profession, and I challenge it. And so therefore, by bringing poetry into it, I might be able to assuage tempers sometimes or conflictual situations by allowing people to see things from a different perspective. And by so doing, I recognize, for example, that the story of Cain and Abel, there is no better example I can find in all of criminal justice that explains criminal law than that case. And I often use that case as my reference point to talk about it. Cain, for example, did the worst crime to this date ever. There's only four people on the planet. Cain kills his brother Abel. That's 25% of the world population genocide in one fell stroke. We have never had that evil visited upon us since then. And yet when Cain represented himself and asked God for a lighter sentence, God delivered a lighter sentence. He said, anybody touch Cain? There was grace even in that heinous crime. And so using those examples and bringing it back to God, people think God is a just God smiting down people and so on. But there's mercy, there's grace, there's love. And people forget to read beyond Cain being thrown out of the garden. They just need to read one or two verses more where Cain moves east of Eden and builds a city. This failed farmer who couldn't offer a proper sacrifice with some crops. He was a failed farmer, yet he became a city builder. If Cain had a second chance, all of us can get a second chance. So that's kind of how I like to integrate these things, you know?
You know, what it's making me think of, right, is my father's father was a farmer, and he primarily grew rice. He grew some other things as well. And so the irrigation there was that, you know, the rice paddies, right? Water is flowing. So his neighbor, who is a Hindu, comes to him and says, you know, if we could take the fence down, the wall, it was literally a wall, a little bund between our properties, the water would flow better. The water is not designed for the law and for our property boundaries. The water flows, you know, through the land. If we let it, we'll have better crops. And so the way I want that story to end is that my Christian grandfather says, of course, brother, right? What a great idea. Instead, my Christian grandfather, who had a modest piece of land and just a few workers and worried about his family, was worried, and he talked to his sons about it, about how he would ever claim his property and claim his boundary line and protect his little family if he took down that wall, because the, you know, he wasn't sure of the neighbor's intent in a place where they were a minority. But that man spoke the truth. The water doesn't mind the law, right? The water is gracious. The water is not ours.
Yes, yes, very true. It's like the fish that Britain is trying so much to protect in this Brexit scenario. The fish doesn't feel English. The fish can swim all around the European Union. And funny enough, this whole thing that has given Britons less freedom, the fish escapes it because it can, it has freedom of movement. So it's a crazy thing.
Gosh. One of the things I appreciate about your work, David, is that you make things accessible to people. And I love that you've been someone who's enjoyed art, and you're now creating art, which has got some of these themes of justice and fairness, and have a different worldview behind them. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, and maybe where people can find your current artwork.
Talking about art is really interesting to talk to somebody like me about art, because my first experience, real experience with art, was going to school and having my art teacher tell me that I'm not good at art. I actually shouldn't do the class. So I didn't choose it as one of my options because he said it wasn't good. Later on, art teachers have explained to me that that art teacher should never have said that, because everybody has a skill in art. And I've said that everybody can do poetry, and I can now say everybody can do art. And for me, it was seeing modern art that made me think, well, I can do it too, you know what I mean? Going to these big galleries and museums and seeing what they call art selling for millions, I thought, well, let me try it too, kind of thing. And then I thought, you know, I'm somebody who appreciates cartoons. In Britain, every self-respecting newspaper will have a cartoonist doing political cartoons. So I thought, let me draw some as well. And I just drew them and emailed them out to people, tweet them out to people and so on, or WhatsApp them out to people, and basically talking about bringing my sense of social justice to my drawings and so on. I've come to enjoy it, and I've come to sharing my creativity. And sometimes when people don't see them for a few days, they say, where are they? I want to keep up to them. So I'm on at Poetry Lawyer on the platforms like Twitter and so on. And that's where I kind of post my cartoons sometimes. I call them knee tunes, because I think that I don't think I deserve to call myself a cartoonist. I know I'm an eater, so I can be a neetoonist. So, you know, in that way, I try to share my art, and, you know, I'd encourage everybody to try their hands at art, because, you know, it's all beautiful, you know. You both, Winnie and Azariah, you are not afraid to break into ears as well. So I just wondered if there are examples you have of pushing something, cradling something, birthing something into the world that you just did because you thought, I'm going to do this, you know? There's an obvious example of your book, Azariah. Winnie, I getting to know you a little bit better, so I'm trying to just work out from both of you, sort of.
It's a great question, because as I'm thinking through this conversation, I'm thinking that sometimes you do these things so often, it doesn't even occur to you that it's a strange thing to do, right? You're always standing in places where you're not expected to be. No one knows why you're there, which is my story. And so I guess the first one would be, I had a very clear call story, a kind of call experience, that I was supposed to be a priest when I was 17, but I was 17, Indian, gay, and a woman. And I remember my first thought was, is there such a thing as a woman priest? Like, I don't even know, but it's so clear that I'm supposed to be one. I wonder how that's going to work, you know? And I kind of, and went forward, you know, and that I feel like a lot of my life has been, well, this is the thing that must be true, so we must go forward, right? These people should be in our congregation. These people are suffering. This art will frame this space in a way that means that we can tell our story differently. So I've often found myself in a spot where you're like, oh, you're kind of shrugging your shoulders with, what? This is hard? And other people find this complicated? Because wouldn't it be right for there to be the story of Syrian refugees at the base of Trinity Church in the shadow of the World Trade Center tower? Of course that would be right, wouldn't it? So whatever that drive is, I hear you, and I so admire it in you that when you know the thing is right, you go for it, right? I think that's the spirit.
And that you didn't embrace it as a barrier, but rather as a commissioning, you know, because you're comprehensively and completely commissioned by God to share the gospel. And that's my experience listening to you, interacting with you. And I'm absolutely grateful that you are there doing your ministry. And believe me, that story will save lives when other people hear it and are liberated from the shackles that other people put on them. So thank you. I think that's powerful. You know,
In terms of thinking about having that courage to go forward, I remember when I was a school child, I was, I still am an introvert, and I used to like to, if I could, drift and hide in the library, and I would just sort of hang out with the books. And there was an old book I found, and it was an old book full of quotes, and I just opened it at random, as I often used to do with my Bible as well. Just put my finger down, and isn't that how everybody does it? And this quote came out to me, and it said this: "The wise person takes more opportunities than they are presented with." And that's been one of the things that has sustained me and helped me to feel, actually, do you know what? I'm going to go and get this. This is something for me. And whether or not, and so with me, there's been a number of barriers, and all that's ever happened is that I've been slowed down, but never quite stopped.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Azariah, because your book now is recommended reading, required reading. I've been to churches where your book is part of the book club study groups. And now you have a product that is out there that is doing great work. And I just salute you guys, you know. It's so touching for me, Winnie, when you said the calling, that you felt it clearly at 17 and obeyed it. You know, Tom Skinner, who I mentioned before, he said people get themselves bothered about sin. What is sin? They try to define it. And they list it out. They have a list of 100 things that are sins, including your skirt is too short, your this is too that. And Tom said, I want you to imagine sin as simply this: independence from God. And at a moment, Winnie, when you could choose independence from God, you didn't. You obeyed the call. And that's powerful to me.
One thought that is still lingering that we haven't quite stated, but I think is assumed in what we're talking about, is I spent a couple of years working in a mental health project for people that weren't housed in Los Angeles, and it was the most formative thing I've done in my life, to think about what it means to try to be a priest in the church. And that so many people, it's so complex, right? Why people, what mental health crisis and what mental health issues are, and the medical, the chemical, the biological nature of that, and the social nature of that, right? That a call, a cry from a soul for help, often clarity about how the society actually works, the oppression of people, you know, the things that create mental health crisis, and physical health crisis and poverty and hunger, like that create these crises, are a reflection of the truth of the world that we live in that is not just, that is not right, that is not grace-filled. And to stand in those spaces seems to me the way we find the truth that you can express through the law and you can express through art. And I think some legal writing is some of the most beautiful writing in the world when it's on the side of what is right. Right? When it's on the side of humanity, it's beautiful. It's just not that often that's what we get. Right? But I can think of some cases in India when they're making the case for same-sex marriage or for human rights of all kinds, where the writing itself is stunning about the dignity of a person. It's better than anything we get in Isaiah, you know, that kind of glory. So it does seem to me that this is all of a piece. We're trying to raise up something that is all of a piece.
That's brilliant. So thank you again for being with us, David. To the listeners, we look forward to our next conversation. But thank you for being part of the Winnie, what do we call this?
Grace?
G-Race? G-Race, yeah, that.
Thank you very much, everybody. Lovely to be in touch.
Thank you.
Azariah Franz-Williams and Winnie Varghese were talking to David Nita. Randolph Matthews composed the music. Grace was produced by me, Rosie Dawson. If you like this episode, you'll find more at heartedge.org or wherever you get your podcasts from. And please do leave us a comment, subscribe and share Grace with your friends. I'm